testimony of God and his prophet. What can be more convincing for a Muslim than the testimony of God and his prophet? For Hazrat Mirza Sahib, we have the testimony of both, and furthermore, the testimony of other prophets. Our own judgment and reason point to the present time as the time for a reformer. The signs which the Holy Prophet, on whom be peace and the blessings of God, enumerated as signs of the Messiah and Mahdi, have become visible. The purity of Hazrat Mirza Sahib's personal life testifies to the truth of his claim. The enemies of Islam, who the promised Messiah had to defeat, have been defeated. The internal dangers from which Muslims suffer have reached their utmost limit. In the presence of the Holy Quran, these dangers could not be worse than they are. The promised Messiah has restated Muslim beliefs and removed the dangerous distortions Islam was undergoing from within. Throughout his life, he enjoyed the help and love of God, as prophets and favorites of God have always done. He was granted victory after victory. He was protected from intrigues and attacks. His enemies suffered disgrace and death, as enemies of the prophets and messengers of God have done in the past. The processes of nature pressed themselves into the service of his cause, and heaven and earth moved in his favor. A special knowledge of the Holy Quran was bestowed on him, also special means for its diffusion. He invited all and sundry, including the most learned, to test his claim to miraculous and intellectual gifts, but nobody dared do so. His miraculous Arabic works and his special knowledge of the meaning of the Holy Quran remained unchallenged. And why? Had not God himself promised that لا يمسه إلا المطهرون, only the pure in heart will have access to the Holy Book, chapter 56, verse 80. He was granted also a knowledge of the unseen. Several thousand examples of this knowledge were shown by him with the special help of God. His prophecies came true and afforded visible evidence of the might and power of God. This accorded with God's own law, for God only grants an abundance of such knowledge to his messengers. Throughout his life, he remained a devotee of God and his prophet. And such devotees are not driven by God out of his grace. He left behind followers sincere in word and deed. A number of them enjoy special contact with God. They are able to quicken the spiritually dead and to resolve spiritual difficulties. They are devoted to caring for religion, indifferent to worldly interests and worldly contacts. They long for the glory and triumph of Islam and care about nothing else. These facts bear witness to the authenticity of Hazrat Mirza Sahib. To refuse to believe in him, therefore, cannot be right or pleasing to God. Muslims who love Islam and the Holy Prophet, who are prepared to place the interests of Islam above their personal interests, will not hesitate to accept the truth after that truth has become so clear. If the arguments which I have enumerated above fail to prove the truth of his claim, then the question is, what better arguments were ever adduced in support of earlier prophets? What better proofs prompted belief in their authenticity? The arguments in support of Hazrat Mirza Sahib are more numerous and more cogent than the arguments in support of earlier prophets, excepting, of course, the Holy Prophet, on whom be peace and the blessings of God. Why then believe in the earlier prophets but not in the promised Messiah? True belief is not belief inherited from parents or accepted as a tradition. True belief is assent after deliberation. If this is not true belief, then we have to deny the authenticity of earlier prophets. If we cannot deny their authenticity, we have to accept that of Hazrat Mirza Sahib, the promised Messiah, on whom be peace. An understanding and intelligent person will adopt the second alternative. He will accept the promised Messiah rather than deny the earlier prophets. He will not hesitate to accept one who has come to proclaim the truth of the Holy Prophet of Islam, to lead Islam to triumph again, and to make Muslims Muslims once more. To accept the will of God and to subscribe to His plan yields His blessings. To resist His plan and His will can yield no blessings. The condition of Islam today stirs our pity. Nobody who loves Islam can view this condition with equanimity. Every lover of Islam will do all he can to save Islam from the dangers which seem to threaten its very existence. He will wish to see it live and prosper again. The enemies of Islam have become so hardened that they can see evil but no good in it. The friends of Islam are disappointed and disgusted. Or, if not disgusted with it, they are at least indifferent to its interests. They profess loyalty to it, but the profession does not travel beyond their lips. True, they care for the political prosperity of Islam. If a Muslim country loses its freedom, they are stricken and raise an alarm. But if hundreds and thousands of Muslims give up Islam and become Christians or Hindus, they are moved not at all. They can raise volunteers for political programs, but not for the exposition and propagation of Islam. A denial of the Turkish Sultan as Khalifa infuriates them, but a denial of the Holy Prophet does not even move them. The political outlook is on the increase. Little interest is taken in Islam as such. Muslims are interested in their political fortunes. The promotion of Islamic tabligh among non-Muslims is a far cry. They do not like even to repel the unrestrained attacks which non-Muslims constantly hurl against Islam. To do so seems inexpedient or impolite. For Islam as such, they have no use. Only the name is retained for political purposes. There is only one way to rescue Islam from this abject state, and that is to accept the promised Messiah and to enter his fold. Islam cannot advance now except under his leadership. Jihad by the sword cannot help Islam. The desideratum is true faith in Islam, a true conception of its teachings, and a united effort on its behalf. Without this, Islam cannot rise again. The Holy Prophet of Islam, say the enemies of Islam, used the sword for its propagation. But for the sword, Islam would not have spread at all. Islam, according to them, could cite no reason or argument in its support. Wittingly or unwittingly, Muslims themselves have supported this attack. God today has ordained that this vile attack on His beloved Prophet should be repulsed and proved false. He has therefore sent one of the followers of the Holy Prophet to defeat the enemies of Islam and to lead Islam to triumph again. Not by physical force, but by argument and persuasion. Only thus will the world be convinced that what the servant can achieve, the master could achieve many times over. For Muslims today, this is the only way. God wants even the enemies of the Holy Prophet to join him as his followers and servants. To make this possible, there is only one way, and that is to present to the world the true Islam, the Islam described anew by the promised Messiah, by methods taught by him, and with the faith recreated by him. This is the way to guide lost mankind back to the true path. If, in the knowledge of God, other avenues existed by which Islam could be helped, why did he close these avenues for us? To remain aloof from the promised Messiah is to hinder the advance of Islam and to help its enemies. Not to join the promised Messiah is to embolden the critics of Islam, to reinforce their attacks on the Holy Prophet, his teaching, his example, and his honor. The Holy Prophet, on whom be peace and the blessings of God, said, "That Ummah can never die which has me at one end and the Messiah, son of Mary, at the other." From this, it seems that belief requires two stone walls for safety. He who rejects the promised Messiah is outside the bounds of safety. He who hinders the promised Messiah is an enemy of Islam. He is not happy at the advance of Islam. If this is not so, why should he oppose the raising of a wall which ensures safety for Islam? His hostility invites the anger of God. It would be better if he had not done so.